Today's program was brought to you by Fiji Water and Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
Hey, Food Radio listeners. I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie, and I'm really excited to share that we're launching a brand new show. Meat and Three is HRN's weekly food news roundup. Tune in for a deep dive and three tasty shorts every Friday evening. It's 15 minutes, so you can listen while you wait for your pizza. This week, the fight for universal free lunch in New York City public schools isn't over yet.
I'm overburdened. I'm overworked. I don't get staff when people are out.
Plus, Dana Cowan, former editor of Food & Wine magazine and host of HRN's Speaking Broadly, catches up with Valerie Lomas, the winner of the Great American Baking Show's Derailed Season 3. Discover how a Danish brewery is motivating people to get fit, and hear Allison Roman speak to the highs and lows of her cookie recipe going viral.
Every time I see anyone in a social setting, that's generally the first thing they ask me is, how are the cookies?
Be better informed and wildly inspired by the stories and people you hear on Meat and Three. Find us on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Hey, you're listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a beautiful Sunday in June today. I am joined by a brilliant author, but she's also a radio producer, so I'm a little bit nervous right now with her in the studio with me. She has long been a contributor for her as a radio producer for NPR, American Public Media, StoryCorps, WNYC's WNYC and the Splendid Table. And she is a first-time cookbook author, too. So I'm really pleased to be joined by Vaughn Diaz.
Thanks so much for having me, Kathy.
Thanks so much for joining. And your first book is called Coconuts and Collards, Recipes and Stories from Puerto Rico to the Deep South.
That's right.
And it is, you know, you are a storyteller. So I was really, you know, this book has that perfect combination that I love to read in a cookbook, which is basically 50% story, 50% recipe. Is that about right?
That's about right. Yeah. That's what I was after.
Yeah. And that's unique, though. You know, I see, you know, many cookbooks come through here, let's face it. And I'm always looking for, like, a little bit more story. So you tell the story, just to kind of, like, briefly familiarize folks with it. You tell a story of the fierce women in your life. So there's a chapter that delves into your grandmother, or Tata, and then your mother, and also yourself throughout. But and then they're divided by sort of sections of recipes that go along with those tales.
Yeah, that's right.
I recently rewatched Like Water for Chocolate,
mm-hmm.
and I couldn't help but notice that you have a quote here from the author of that novel, the Mexican author, Laura, was it?
Esquivel.
Mm-hmm. Were you inspired by that book?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I most certainly was influenced and inspired by the women in my life. I think like a lot of, let's face it, like a lot of young Latina women, I was raised in this very strong matriarchal little mini society that was my family that was largely absent of men. And my mom is, I would say, not as much of an eater as I am, but my mother is a lover of good storytelling. And Like Water for Chocolate was one of the first actually movies and then books that I ever experienced that I was like, huh, there's this magical quality to food that I think I experience. I don't know that I experienced at the level of, you know, chiles en nogado making you cry mm-hmm. at a dinner table, but I had certainly been sort of moved to have really strong feelings by food that I ate. And I think that played a big role in me wanting to write a book that captured how important food is to us emotionally, psychologically, mm-hmm. And how much it can be a binder to culture.
Yeah. I love that you have, you know, you emphasize cooking with your senses and also with your, with the sense of family history. Like, for instance, you write, you know, with history and culture as your guides, the path to creating delicious foods that you make and those around you, that make you and those around you smile, can be incredibly joyful and can reveal connections to your past and to others that you wouldn't otherwise see.
Yeah.
So cooking as a sort of personal exploration as well as creativity is really important too.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly important to me. I gave a TEDx talk in 2015 that focused on mofongo as kind of the I mean, the whole talk was about mofongo and how we can look at a dish like mofongo. So I don't have a recipe in this book for mofongo. I do have a recipe in the Great America, America the Great Cookbook for a mofongo recipe that, that my, my grandmother helped me develop. But, it, you know, at its root, it is plantains that are deep fried and smashed and then combined with garlic and chicharron or fried pork skins. And if you look at the dish and start to kind of take it apart, you see indigenous influence, African influence, Spanish influence, and American influence all wrapped up in one ball of deep fried plantain. And, you know, dishes like that, looking in my family's pantry, particularly when I was growing up in the South, and would look at my American friends' pantries versus what was in my pantry made me ask a lot of questions about, like, well, what is adobo and why do we use it? And those kinds of single ingredients a lot of times inspired me to ask questions.
Yeah. So you grew up at first in Puerto Rico and then you moved to Atlanta.
Just outside of Atlanta, yeah.
So did that kind of put a sharper focus on the differences of your household food? Do you become more interested in exploring them once they were no longer, you know, the normal things that other kids had in their cabinets?
I think I did. You know, I don't remember living in Puerto Rico as a child. I only remember my trips back, which were fairly frequent. We went back at least once a year. And as I talk about a lot in Coconuts and Collards, I would go back sometimes for the entire summer and be just with my grandmother, who was this incredible force. And, you know, so that going back and forth, I think, was part of what made me deeply curious because, you know, if I had just gone back, I don't know, kind of once in a blue moon at Christmas time, my understanding of Puerto Rican food might be defined by holiday meals. Mm. But as it was, you know, I got to see kind of how people really ate. I started to notice how different the grocery stores were. And I started to wonder, okay, well, you know, why do they only have this small assortment of vegetables in Puerto Rican grocery stores, whereas where I live, you know, in the South, there's an abundance of different kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I do think that it highlighted the differences, but also highlighted the similarities. In the second chapter of Coconuts and Collards, I talk a lot about my experience kind of becoming a Southerner, because I really at times feel as Southern as I do Puerto Rican. The South is my home in much more of a palpable way. And I think that going between those two places enabled me to see how similar preparations were for certain dishes, the ingredients that we shared, and to start to ask questions like, okay, so how, you know, what we call pernil, they might call roast pork shoulder in the South, but they're basically the same process. So,
Right. Yeah,
I think that it inspired as much kind of interest in the similarities as the differences.
Yeah, and like your name's, you know, what do you call it? The titular recipe here, Coconuts and Collards. It looks like just a really natural and beautiful braised collard greens with coconut milk.
Yeah, you know, it is just the simplest recipe. Some kind of like magic happens in, I think, there's some kind of alchemy there that I've talked about this recipe a lot because it is the book's namesake, right? And it is kind of a, I don't know, perfect representation of what I was trying to do with the recipes in the book, which is to take one ingredient from one culture, one homeland, ingredient from another culture and another homeland, and figure out how they might fit. If they did, you know, it's not quite fusion because it's sort of like it's ingredients that lived alongside each other in my home, in my body. and figuring out, oh, well, you know, where do they fit naturally and where are the combinations where they really shine.
Mm-hmm. And you also try to, you write to that you like to try to lighten things up a little bit where possible, or when you feel like it.
Absolutely. I mean, I prefer not to eat very heavy, very greasy food. I have a very similar composition to my mom, who just prefers eating largely vegetarian food. And I also prefer on the day-to-day to eat largely vegetarian food. I love pork, and I literally, there's not a thing on the planet I don't like to eat. But Puerto Rican food, in my experience and in my memory, you know, a lot of times I would go back for the summer over the holidays and I would just gorge myself on the food because it was so delicious. And I would feel so terrible because the food was just incredibly heavy, mm-hmm. and a very difficult thing for you to eat at that level. And so much of it. So, I really wanted to figure out how do I take a Puerto Rican recipe, keep it delicious, but just make it a little bit less of a, I don't know, kind of a bomb in your stomach, mm-hmm. which a lot of Puerto Rican dishes are for me. I think I did a pretty good job. I ultimately wanted them to stay delicious. So sometimes that means that you got to keep something in there. I mean, my fried chicken recipe is just a standard fried chicken recipe. Right. There's nothing healthy about that.
No, I love that there's a good combination here of classics and then updated classics and then twists, you know, the Southern twists. I think it's interesting though, you mentioned that historically Puerto Rican food has reflected a lack of access to healthy ingredients and subsequently a reliance on making things pretty heavy and filling as a, you know, farming and working class community. The reliance on heavy foods has imbued itself within the cuisine for a pretty long time. But you write that, you know, the combinations born of necessity and fusion also create a uniquely Caribbean flavor profile that is rife with potential. So is your goal to sort of tap into the potential of creating a sort of more vegetable forward focused cuisine using the same flavors and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I use the word Caribbean really deliberately in what I wrote there, because so much of what you see in Puerto Rican food, particularly around access, around the availability of vegetables, the use of vegetables in the cuisine, the heaviness of the dishes, is something you see in the Dominican Republic, in Haiti, in Jamaica, in Cuba. It's not necessarily unique to Puerto Rico, but Puerto Rico is my lens, right? Mm-hmm. And I do believe strongly that because of the way that Puerto Rico was a worker colony, you know, largely a cane sugar cultivation colony for Spain for a very long time, and then transitions into this U.S. territory where the primary industry is tourism, and there isn't really sort of a movement there to kind of elevate Puerto Rican cuisine, to cultivate the land in Puerto Rico for vegetables in a way that it hasn't been cultivated before. Instead, the food has continued to be, I think, largely reliant on filling food that you might eat if you were working heavy. And, you know, even though things have changed dramatically in Puerto Rico and it is no longer sort of defined by this cane culture, you still see the evidence in the history of the food.
Mm-hmm. Of the everyday food.
Yeah.
But that's starting to change a little bit, as you note, when you have your last section called Retorno, mm-hmm. and a triumphant return back to Puerto Rico and a trip to a wonderful restaurant that you discovered there. Does that give you a sense that the cuisine is slightly or slowly starting to change a bit?
You know, I think I am speaking from my experience, right?
And I
grew up on the mainland. So in many ways, my lens for Puerto Rican food is what I see from here and what I see on visits. So a lot of what I speak to, I think, comes from diaspora Puerto Rican food mm-hmm. culture, the things that we maybe ate because they were the things that we had access to, or maybe because they were nostalgic, you know, dishes that we might only eat at Christmas on the island maybe become more everyday here because they are that tie. And what I have seen in Puerto Rico when I've gone back You know, there have been several articles written, one in the New York Times, about a return to growing vegetables that actually had never really been cultivated in Puerto Rico. I have an incredibly easy time eating vegetarian food, eating light. Tons of beautiful fresh fruit grow in Puerto Rico. And so I think, you know, it's difficult to speak to an entire culture, particularly post-Maria, because it's not clear to me how that hurricane is transforming foodways in Puerto Rico as we speak.
Right.
But I do think that, a quick anecdote from my last trip to Puerto Rico that I write about in that book is that people were obsessed with cúrcuma, which is turmeric. Mm-hmm. And everywhere I went, people were putting turmeric in everything because it has health benefits. Mm. And so older people, there was fresh turmeric in all of the green markets. And I saw that as a sign of, you know, a culture of people who are looking at the nutritive value of their food just as much as if it tastes good.
Yeah, and interest, curiosity, and new health benefits.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, at the time. Mm-hmm. So like, aren't we all here?
We must.
I want to talk a lot more about some of these recipes.
Sure.
And also some recent developments in food media in general, right after a quick little commercial break.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe, overlooking Lily Pool Terrace. Chef Rob Newton and chef de cuisine Morgan Jarrett offer warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
All right, and we're back chatting more with Vaughn Diaz. She is a radio producer and also a cookbook author. The latest book, or her first book, and latest book, is Coconuts and Collards. So, Vaughn, sort of recently I ran into you at the James Beard Media Awards, and that was everyone has been talking about how it's been a pivotal year in terms of the awards diversity and the diversity of the winners. And it definitely seemed like a lot of the winners at the Media Awards were really electrifying the crowd with their speeches and the triumphant, mentions of, immigrant stories being very crucial to food media in general and our culinary landscape in general. This has been quite the talk of the town lately.
It has.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, as an author of a book about Puerto Rican food. How hard was it to get this book published? I have a sneaking suspicion that it may have been a little difficult.
It was very challenging. I really should say that I am incredibly grateful to my agent, Lisa Eckes, and to University Press of Florida, who took this project on, despite what I kept hearing through the process of trying to sell it. Was a book that I think people had a difficult time wrapping their brain around. I know from other cookbook authors who write about what is known often as regional cuisine, that it can be a difficult sell in an increasingly struggling publishing market. And so I feel like that was an initial barrier that I had to my book that, I write about a food that is really specific and not a food that you go to a James Beard award-winning restaurant to eat. It is, mm-hmm. I think, thought of as sometimes as street food, as kind of comfort food. And so I think that that was an initial barrier to publishers really being able to get why they should take a chance, why they should be the ones to publish the first kind of unusual Puerto Rican cookbook to come out in a really long time. And in addition, I think I'm not the first to say that being a woman of color in food writing spaces, you can feel really alone sometimes. You go to events, you speak on panels, and at times, I think I've had the experience, like many other of my colleagues, of feeling a little tokenized and also just feeling like I didn't see myself reflected in the events or in things being published. And certainly speaking specifically to food media, right, to magazines and newspapers and television shows, not seeing myself reflected there either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is I don't think we can underestimate how difficult it is to break into an industry that is very challenging, that a lot of times requires you to be a freelancer, right? So you're dealing with some economic instability potentially for a long time, depending on your project. I, like a lot of my colleagues, like, I don't own a restaurant. I'm a self-taught cook, you know? And so all of the things that might kind of have elevated my status to make me a little bit more noticed, I didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, I felt sometimes alone at sea and without mentors, right? Like without another kind of big Puerto Rican or many big Puerto Rican chefs
right.
to kind of look to and be like, I want to be like that. Or, you know, those are the people who are going to support me when I come out. So, yeah, it was very challenging. I've always been really transparent that it took me 2 attempts, 1 revisal of the proposal and about 1.5 years
mm-hmm.
to sell the book
right.
with an agent. And that feels like a pretty long time compared to what I've heard other people's experiences are. It also, you know, I was also then asked to turn it around pretty quickly, which felt, I don't know that's that unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I think I had 9 months total to do all of it.
This whole collective experience sounds like it's a little bit not very empowering sounding, right?
Yeah, it was challenging.
I mean,
it's certainly along the way, it felt like a challenge. I've also always been really transparent in telling people I had to have a full-time gig
right.
alongside my book project mm-hmm. in order to make it as beautiful as I wanted to, and to have it to be able to preserve the kind of creative and intellectual integrity
yeah.
that I wanted to have. I mean, I opened the book with a quote from Sidney Mintz, who
mm-hmm.
is one of the foremost cultural anthropologists of our time. And, you know, for me, it was really important that the book have, that it be smart. And that was also something I think that was a little bit unusual. It felt like an uphill battle for a minute, but also just one that was so much fun.
Good.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't have written this book if I didn't.
No, of course.
I would never have written a book, period, if I couldn't have enjoyed the process. And,
right. And had stories that were really worthy of telling. I mean,
thank you for saying that.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
You could
see
the passion throughout this book.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think that part of what is really exciting about this moment where I feel like folks who have been at this for a long time are being recognized
mm-hmm.
is that, you know, every door is an opening for another person to walk through. And I was mentored by one of my longtime mentors is Kathy Gunst, who is a prolific cookbook author. She has written 15 cookbooks, largely about kind of local food and Maine. And she has been writing about food since it wasn't a cool thing to do, like late 70s, early 80s. And she saw promise in me and completely pro bono edited some of my early work and was an incredible champion for me, recommended me to do a TEDx talk. And I mean, her opening doors for me changed my life.
That sounds like great endorsement and a great, it's a great mentorship too.
Yeah. I mean, really, I couldn't have done it without her. And, it's now my responsibility to start opening doors. And you know, I've been so moved to see Julia Tertian's, Equity at the Table project, which I'm featured on that website and, delighted to go to it and see all the faces of all these, you know, just
mm-hmm.
amazing, interesting people that I didn't even know existed who are now, you know, now we're part of a community. We're
right.
building a community. So the next time that like a young Puerto Rican woman is like, hey, I want to do a completely vegetarian Puerto Rican cookbook, you know, like there's someone that her future publisher can look to be like, oh, well this, you know, this book did like this and people were really interested. And, you know, it's a big part of the process, you know,
right.
each of us that like gets a little bit of coverage and is celebrated opens a door for the next person to maybe do better than we do.
That's very hopeful. I also think that all eyes are now on gatekeepers in the food media to,
mm-hmm.
Take the cues from what we've learned, from the success of books that have been received and, you know, have won these awards, but also were regional or quote unquote niche, which is a refrain I seem to hear a lot with with my projects. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think that, do you think that we will see that reflected in the choices that are made in publishing going forward?
Is that? I would like to think so. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that part of what is happening as the tide turns is that publishers are increasingly being held accountable. And, you know, my colleague, Nicole Taylor, who has been at this game for a long time, you know, she used to be the only voice in the room. I don't know that it's fair to say the only voice in the room. She's certainly the loudest voice in the room. And she stuck to her politics and she stuck to her really wise analysis of what she saw around her. And now her voice is really elevated. And those of us who maybe weren't aware or weren't in food writing at the time, or maybe didn't have the courage to speak up, like now we're speaking up more and more. And which is why I've always been really transparent with people about how difficult it was. Mm-hmm. What I shouldn't say how difficult, like what an incredible challenge it was to write a cookbook and get it published. We need to hold the publishers as accountable on the book level as we do the people who select guests for their TV and radio shows. You know, one of the things that has stood out to me as far as how we need to start thinking about what we produce differently is the Netflix series of Chef's Table. Mm-hmm. The first season of that show that I ever watched was like, man, this is really gorgeous, but there's a real lack of diversity of who I'm seeing celebrated on this show. Now, a chef's table uses Michelin stars
that's
the rubric for the entire show is Michelin star awarded restaurants.
Right.
And so there's a built-in a handicap
criteria
to the show that they're not going to surpass until more chefs of color receive Michelin stars, you know? And so that's the kind of thing I think that we're going to start seeing a shift where we don't create projects or TV shows or magazines that have built in problems. Like we need to start thinking about that from the beginning. How do we ensure that we're creating something that has equitable representation and also equitable access for the people writing, the people we're writing about, and create a real, you know, a more holistic view of what's going on in the food world.
And I think it's important to point out that, I think a lot of people have made this point that, including Julia Tertian recently, that, you know, some of these choices amongst food media are self-fulfilling prophecy. So, you know, if you create this criteria like a Michelin star and it's only elevating these voices or so forth, and or in publishing, if you, you know, say something's niche, you know, you have a smaller advance for one project.
Yep.
And it's going to be more challenging. You're going to have less resources thrown at that book project, and it's not going to do as well.
Yeah.
So it's like this machine that needs to be reanalyzed.
Yeah. And I mean, I am really thrilled to see people taking apart concepts of diversity and concepts of equity, because I think for too long people have been conflating those two ideas and thinking that simply having representation is like that's how you solve the problem, versus we already know, you know, having people of color at the table is as important as giving them an award and putting them on a stage, you know? Well, and I have to say as an aside too, I happen to have grown up in the South. That is where my family happened to end up. And a lot of conversations around Southern food hinge on soul food, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and who owns soul food? Are we celebrating the voices of enslaved people who are the architects of that food, right? And it's interesting coming in as a Puerto Rican to that conversation, because I see those same similarities in the way we talk about Puerto Rican food, a kind of tokenizing of areas of cuisine or particular dishes, an essentializing, right, of that kind of cuisine that I think has a lot of similarity with the way that Black folks have been erased from the culinary history of the United States. And those are the kinds of conversations, you know, my opportunity now to be at the table, now I get to be a part of kicking that dust up so that it's not such a polarized conversation. We're talking about white people, we're talking about Black people. We are talking about a lot of different cultures and foods that are, you know, have been historically at times completely erased or appropriated and turned into things that, you know, look nothing like their original dishes. So I feel very, very hopeful. And I also feel very grateful that I have a book out at a moment where, you know, I can now join this very exciting, impactful conversation.
Yeah. It does seem like a moment. A few weeks ago, we had Virginia Willis on her latest book. Yeah, and we were having a lot of conversations about what Southern cuisine is. So, and I love what you said about, you know, what you've written now hopefully opens the door for more voices, and maybe you'll get to be that person who's a mentor.
So, I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's about all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for a really, really great conversation, Vaughn.
Thank you, Kathy. It's been a pleasure.
And everyone can check out Coconuts and Collards out now from University of Philadelphia?
Florida.
Florida Press. All right. Well, thanks everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.